needs to be discussed. The decades-long oppression, suppression of an entire nation, the denial, the bare basic denial of basic rights needs to be discussed. The whole idea that Israel could keep a permanent occupation, permanent colonization, permanent siege, permanent denial of refugees to go back to their homes with the help of the U.S. administration and the rest of the West to really bypass the Palestinian issue. That is what we are going to discuss soon. Because, you know, for the last so many years, the West has enabled Israel to actually be convinced that it can bypass us. That the Biden, remember the Trump administration. I was the ambassador in Washington during the Trump time, if you remember, Amy. And you know,
and explain what happened.
The Trump administration, the Trump administration has simply completely gave Israel the stamp of approval to undermine any prospect of a two-state solution and to actually keep believing that they could turn their occupation permanent. But then comes the Biden administration, who promised during the election otherwise, but they failed miserably. They did not reverse any of the Biden, of the Trump's administration, very lethal policies, and actually they doubled down on the psychology and on the mindset of bypassing the Palestinian issue. They pushed for further normalization between Israel and the non-conflicting parties, you know, Emirates, what have you, even Saudi Arabia. And the fact is, The Biden administration knows that Israel's issue is with us, not far away. So there are two agendas here. There was one of Netanyahu and co, because successive Israeli governments, which is a non-solution agenda, as basic as that. And there was the Palestinian and the international agenda, which is so-called the two-state solution, i.e. Israel has got to end its occupation. The Biden administration has got, they did nothing whatsoever in the last 3 years or so to actually go in that direction. Everything they did was in the opposite direction, and now they are in this mood of trying to curb Israel, but they are failing to do so because they will not be able to use the stick. They are unable to tell Israel, we will stop arming you, we will stop funding you, we will stop protecting you in the Security Council. So Israel is not listening. That's the unfortunate situation.
Ambassador, I want to get your response to a tweet posted Thursday by Secretary of State Tony Blinken. He said, this has been an extraordinarily dangerous year for press around the world. Many killed, many more wounded, hundreds detained, attacked, threatened, injured, simply for doing their jobs. I'm profoundly grateful to the press for getting accurate, timely information to the people. He wasn't talking specifically about what's happened in Gaza, but I'd like you to address this. You addressed a rally recently where you talked about the astounding number of journalists who have been killed in Gaza. The numbers are believed to be up to something like 105, and the significance of journalists being killed.
It's part of Israel's deliberate targeting of journalists all over. And remember, Shireen Abu Akleh, and Mr. Blinken was involved in the case of Shireen Abu Akleh. And yet again, America put its weight behind quitting Israel of any responsibility about Shireen. And by the way, Shireen is both Palestinian citizen and American citizen. But now
the Al Jazeera reporter
targeting Al Jazeera, but a Palestinian icon, a beloved Palestinian voice. Of the Palestinian people, a journalist, and you know, she's a most prominent journalist, sniped, killed by an Israeli soldier in Jenin as she was covering live events. And you know, Mr. Blinken was involved, the U.S. was involved, the FBI was involved about their own citizen, and nothing came out. Israel is the exception. Everybody just in every U.S. administration has just simply looked the other way when Israel commits crimes. That's the issue. Israel has been made so immune above every law, above every single basic human value. Now, back to your question, this is also part of the suicide. I'm sorry, the suicide of the Palestinian people, because if you kill their doctors, their professors, their journalists, etc., then if you kill their elites and the sectors that provide life, be it health, be it education, be it media, because media is an integral part of any society, then the society will be unable to survive. And go back, more than 100 journalists have been killed in Gaza, and the count is still going on. So this is part of making our society simply lifeless, unable to survive, unable to stay. And let me say this, maybe this will sound a bit emotional, but it's not going to happen, because we have a very, very special society, very rooted, very traditioned, and knows how to come together in these moments and knows how to survive. We have learned how to survive since the Nakba of 1948. So Israel can break all these laws. Israel can break the very basic human values, but it cannot break us. That's a fact. And look at Gaza. You are following what is happening in Gaza. All what Israel is doing is just exposing the savagery, the barbarism this whole entity is about, and our need to end the idea that you can control things by military means. You can't control things by military means. You can only control things when you end the illegalities and the occupation.
Ambassador Hassam Zumlat, I want to thank you for being with us. Palestinian ambassador to the United Kingdom, who himself lost family members in Gaza, where he is from. Coming up, Francesca Albanese, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territory. Stay with us. In the Depth by Ruba Shamshu. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to look at Israel's assault on Gaza, we're joined by Francesca Albanese, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territory. Earlier this week, she denounced reports that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has endorsed expelling all Palestinians from Gaza. Israeli news outlets report Netanyahu told a group of Israeli lawmakers Monday regarding voluntary immigration, this is the direction we're going in, he said. Palestinian leaders denounced Netanyahu for embracing what they describe as ethnic cleansing. Earlier this week, Francesca Albanese tweeted, quote, voluntary migration, no matter how Israeli government calls it, forced displacement is a crime, prosecutable under the Rome Statute. Its architect shall be investigated, prosecuted by the ICC. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Francesca Albanese. Thank you for joining us. Talk about what has been reported as Netanyahu's plan.
Good morning, Amy. The plan becomes clearer and clearer. We have heard statements made by Israeli politicians, Israeli military commanders referring to the need for the Palestinians from Gaza to move south first, and then more and more south. But at the same time, we have seen soldiers entering the Gaza Strip saying, quote unquote, with the instructions to destroy, displace and settle. And the more the time passes, the more it becomes clear that there is a plan in certain corners of the government to repossess Gaza, to reconquest Gaza, and to convert it into an Israeli area. But this is pure madness, and it's utterly illegal. Now, it's not new, because forced displacement is the main trait that characterizes Israeli occupation in the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. It has gone through 56 years, not to mention what has happened before. But now this, I mean, it's so cynical to call it voluntary migration and continue to evoke as the only possibility for the Palestinians in Gaza to survive, to move somewhere else, to the Sinai or somewhere else in the Arab region, saying that the Palestinians are Arabs. This is like saying that Italians can go anywhere because they are Europeans. This is so racist. But plus, it's forced displacement. It's a crime against humanity and cannot be. Again, it should be stopped. It's shocking to see the silence of the international community in the face of these unfathomable ideas.
In a post earlier this week, you compared the Israeli assault on Gaza to the genocidal massacres in Srebrenica and Rwanda. Can you explain?
Yeah, actually, I didn't necessarily compare the two. I'm saying that the international community has been silent and unable to prevent the genocide in Rwanda, to prevent the genocide in Bosnia-Herzegovina, in Srebrenica. And in the same way, it's looking idle at what's happening in the Gaza Strip. But it's worse because, as the ambassador Zumlok was saying that before, I think it's true, this is televised. If people had not realized what the Nakba is, this is ongoing under our eyes. But the genocidal element is more clear. Here is not about just displacing people, pushing them out. The killing, the number of killing in the Gaza Strip, which has been turned into an assassination factory, to use an expression by journalists in Plus 972, Israeli journalists in 972. But also, look at what's going on in the West Bank, where there is no Hamas military control, military presence. And still, this year, 500 Palestinians have been killed. So there is a mass killing of Palestinians ongoing, accompanied by genocidal incitement. And this must be stopped. This triggers an obligation to prevent genocide among member states. But again, no one seems very preoccupied in the international community other than human rights actors and, yeah, those concerned with
Francesca Albanese, you are the UN Special Rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territory. Israel's announced it's going to stop automatically granting visas to employees of the United Nations after it accused the UN of being complicit partners with Hamas. Your response?
Baseless accusations. I'm appalled at how these attacks against the UN continue to escalate. Because on the one hand, you have two big failures here. And one is induced and the other is inevitable. The induced one is the political failure of the UN, because it's paralyzed because of the political, of the US veto in the UN Security Council. They were close to a vote on the ceasefire, but there was the US veto. And on the other hand, the other failure, which is inevitable, it's the humanitarian machinery of the UN system, which is also under attack. The UN should be strengthened. The multilateral system is what can drag us out and reestablish a modicum of order here. But look, what Israel is doing is raising the attacks against the UN, because the UN are being increasingly critical in the face of the crimes that Israel commits through and through. But the threatening UN staff of withdrawing visas, this is not new. I mean, we have to, for example, those in my position, this is not something about me particularly, but also the three special rapporteurs on the occupied Palestinian territory who have preceded me have not been able to enter the occupied Palestinian territory because of the Israeli decision not to cooperate with the mandate, which is a violation of UN member states' obligation to comply with the UN, including its investigative mechanisms. Israel behaves the same way with various commissions of inquiries, including the current Commission of Inquiry on Israel-Palestine. And more seriously, Israel has basically kicked out 3 years ago the office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. This has gone completely in silence, but withdrawing visa to all its international employees who are operating now from Amman. Such a weird precedent. Again, this is the thing. The UN has also accepted Israel's hubris to become fatter and Fatah. And this is the reality today, that you have Israeli ambassadors and political leaders smearing everyone. Special rapporteurs, committee, commission of inquiries, the US, the UN Secretary General, everyone. Where shall we draw the line?
Let me ask you about information new out this morning. UNRWA's posted on X that this year has been the deadliest year in the West Bank on record, with a total of 504 Palestinians killed this year. I mean, this is for the whole year. It was already the deadliest year before October 7th, when Hamas attacked Israel. Now, more than 300 since October 7th, Palestinians in the West Bank have been killed by either Israeli soldiers or settlers.
Yes, primarily soldiers. And this is one, probably the only issue with an otherwise great report by the UN Human Rights Office. It has pointed to the disproportionate, unnecessary use of force through military means, which have resulted, yes, in the killing of 500 people, 500 Palestinians this year, mostly by Israeli soldiers. The emphasis on settler violence, though, while it's true, shouldn't distract from the fact that the settlers are there as part of an enterprise, the Israeli enterprise, to colonize and annex occupied Palestinian territory. The Israel, as a state, should be held responsible also for the actions of the settlers, which are never prosecuted, by the way. So that, but again, you know, we have to think that, yes, this has been the deadliest year since 2005, when the UN started collecting the data outside of conflicts against Gaza. But in Gaza, 4,000 people, including 1,000 children, had been killed in 16 years, during five wars occurred during 16 years of blockade. This is just for those who believe that everything started on the 7th of October. No, it didn't. The situation was appalling before. And we have a special rapporteur. I belong to a community which includes Israeli and Palestinian human rights organizations and many scholars who have called for the end of the oppression of the Palestinian people, because and the end of the annexation and colonization of the occupied territory, because this was the only way to guarantee the security, the safety, the well-being of both Palestinians and Israelis, and we have gone unheard, unfortunately.
Last question, the role of the United States. In resolution after resolution, they vetoed any call for a ceasefire. The last one, they didn't veto it, but they abstained once they got the UN Security Council not to include ceasefire in the language. Where do you see the UN going and the role of the United States in all of this? How powerful, how important is the United States, Francesca?
The United States is very important, very powerful, very influential. It's the only single state that can really change the dynamics between Israel and the occupied Palestinian territory, not only because the United States provides a lot of means and military aid to Israel, but also because it shelters Israel from its responsibilities, political and legal responsibilities. Again, yes, the last resolution, I mean, the U.S. managed to water it down to a point that it makes no sense. The only thing that is needed now, and it's already late, is a ceasefire. So the fact that the U.S. is still sort of not considering this as an option, because it doesn't, and it continues to engage with Israel as it would be, it was business as usual, shows profound disrespect toward the Palestinian people. And again, this is a level of dehumanization that I've never seen in other. I mean, it's not new from Israel, but it's new at this level, in this, with this magnitude, like endorsed also in the U.S., but also in Europe. I mean, there is huge responsibilities, and the U.S. is leading the front of those who could change the reality on the ground and chose not to do so.
How do you see this ending in the last minute we have? Francesca Albanese, UN Special Rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territory, as I was just discussing with the Palestinian ambassador in the United Kingdom. Netanyahu just canceled his war cabinet meeting under pressure from the even more far right finance minister, Smotrich. Where is this headed?
I know it's heading towards further madness unless and until it stops. And it's going to be a very heavy, loaded, dark, grim future for both Palestinians and Israelis. So there should be a huge U-turn here and restore international law, basic respect, equality, human rights for both the Israelis and the Palestinians. And it starts with a ceasefire and with a protective presence that allows, that supervises the withdrawal of Israeli troops. This is the moment to end the occupation. And it cannot happen without, I think, a protective presence that guarantees for a while the safety and security of both.
Francesca Albanese, UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, speaking to us from Italy. Coming up, the state of Maine has become the second state, joining Colorado, to bar Donald Trump from the Republican primary ballot over his role in the January 6th insurrection. Back in 20 seconds. Janine by Al Fanoun, Palestinian dance troupe. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. On Thursday, the state of Maine joined Colorado in barring Donald Trump from the Republican primary ballot over his role in the January 6th insurrection. Maine's Secretary of State, Shenna Bellows, issued a written decision saying the insurrection clause in the 14th Amendment makes the former president ineligible to run for public office again. Trump's campaign has vowed to appeal the ruling. A campaign spokesperson described the Bellows decision as a, quote, hostile assault on American democracy, unquote. The U.S. Supreme Court will likely have the final say on Trump's ballot eligibility. Last week, Colorado's Supreme Court barred Trump from Colorado's primary ballot, but Michigan's Supreme Court has ruled that he can stay on the Michigan ballot. Meanwhile, just last night, California's Secretary of State declined to remove Donald Trump from the presidential primary ballot, despite a call for her to do so from the state's lieutenant governor. California's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom had opposed the move, saying, quote, we defeat candidates at the polls. For more, we're joined by John Boniface, president of Free Speech for People, which has filed legal challenges to Trump's eligibility to appear on the ballot in a number of states, including Minnesota, Michigan, and Oregon. Can you respond to what's happened in Maine and then talk, John, about those who are opposed to this, Republican and Democratic alike, who say this should be decided by the people at polls, not by courts, whether Donald Trump can run for president again?
Yes, thank you, Amy, for having me. This is a highly significant decision that the Maine Secretary of State has issued, barring Donald Trump from the ballot in the state of Maine because he is disqualified under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. That critical constitutional provision makes clear that anyone who takes an oath of office and then engages in insurrection is forever barred from public office again. Secretary Bellows had a duty to enforce the mandate of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment against Donald Trump, and she carried out that duty, and we thank her for that. And secretaries of state all across the country must now follow her courage and carry out their duty to bar Donald Trump from their state ballots. And the Colorado Supreme Court as well had a duty to follow the Constitution, and they did. For those who say that this needs to be decided at the ballot box, that is ignoring the very purpose of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. We have in our Constitution basic qualifications for serving as President of the United States. You have to be 35 years of age by the time of the inauguration. You have to be a natural-born citizen. And you have to have not taken an oath of office and then engaged in insurrection. These are qualifications for serving the office of president. And if we are going to ignore this critical constitutional provision, we do it with the risk of setting a dangerous precedent going forward, that elected officials can now incite an insurrection, mobilize and facilitate an insurrection, threatening our republic, and then move on to serve in public office again. It is contrary to what the framers of the 14th Amendment intended, and is exactly why we will be continuing to file challenges to Donald Trump's eligibility in other key states.
So talk about where Article 3 of the 14th Amendment came from. Talk about its roots in the Confederacy.
Yes, this critical provision of the 14th Amendment was, of course, part of that amendment enacted after the Civil War, after the first insurrection in our nation's history. And it was designed to address ex-Confederates in positions of power or who sought to attain positions of power who had previously taken an oath to defend the Constitution. And the framers of the 14th Amendment were clear that if you took that prior oath to defend the Constitution and then you engaged in leading the first insurrection in our nation, the Civil War, then you are barred from holding public office again. These ex-Confederates who had taken that oath and then engaged in the insurrection were seen as threats to the republic. But it's important to note that the framers debated and decided that the 14th Amendment, Section 3, would not solely apply to the ex-Confederates. It would apply to any future insurrection. They were prospective in their relief as well. They recognized that there needed to be this safeguard to our democracy. So for people who say this is anti-democratic small d, they're getting it totally wrong. This is about defending our democracy, defending our Constitution. You cannot allow people who take that oath of office to defend the Constitution and then turn around and incite an insurrection, as Donald Trump did, and then say they're going to serve in public office again, especially not the highest office of the land. That's what's at stake here. It's about defending our republic.
What states might do this next? In the New York Times, a decision expected soon in Oregon, where the same group that filed the Michigan lawsuit, your group, John, Free Speech for People, is seeking to have the state Supreme Court remove Donald Trump from that presidential primary ballot. And what about this going to the U.S. Supreme Court? What do you expect from this? Where Donald Trump has appointed three of the court justices.
Yes. Well, first on Oregon, we represent a diverse group of voters challenging Donald Trump's eligibility to serve on the presidential primary and general election ballot there. We filed what's known as a mandamus action before the state Supreme Court, meaning that we want the Oregon Supreme Court to take it up immediately. And importantly, the Secretary of State of Oregon, in her filings before the state Supreme Court, agreed that the matter should be taken up immediately by the state Supreme Court. This is a matter of critical importance for the state and for the nation. So we're waiting on the state Supreme Court to take the next action with respect to those filings, and we expect that to happen soon. As far as the U.S. Supreme Court, people do highlight that three of those appointees were Donald Trump appointees, but it's worth noting that after the 2020 election, as we know, Donald Trump filed more than 60 court cases all across the country trying to overturn the 2020 election based on the big lie, the lie that there was massive fraud in the 2020 election with no evidence whatsoever. He lost every single one of those cases, and every time he tried to get one of those cases to the Supreme Court, he lost that as well. The Supreme Court never agreed with with his claims at all, and they never even agreed to take any of his cases.
So we have 10 seconds, John.
I would just say that we have to see what the Supreme Court will do, but they ought to follow the mandate of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment and the Constitution.
We have to leave it there. John Boniface, president of Free Speech for People. And that does it for our show. A huge congratulations to our producer, John Hamilton, and his wonderful wife, Yara, on the birth of their son this morning, William Dernay Hamilton. And congratulations to Jasmine, his sister, as well. On Monday, New Year's Day, we'll bring you a special on Julian Assange, the imprisoned WikiLeaks founder of the High Court of Justice in London. We'll hear what may be Assange's final appeal soon. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Listen to music and podcasts from CGSF 90.1 FM with our radio app. It's on-the-go listening made easy. You can tune into all our music, spoken word, and multicultural shows using your device. Our app lets you set reminders so you'll never miss your favorite show again. Stay connected to CGSF 90.1 FM through our community radio app. Download the app from the Apple Store or get it on Google Play.